Good evening, ladies. Tonight, we're going to have third in the series of our program dealing with women in the laboring force. We're fortunate to have with us tonight two speakers, Dr. Gretchen Kreuter, who teaches at St. Olaf College in North, is it Northfield?
I think so.
Okay. And Dr. Hyman Berman, who teaches American history at the University of Minnesota. Gretchen will begin the lecture tonight on the early laws in labor that dealt with women and how some of them were rather restrictive. Gretchen?
Well, perhaps to the relief of all of you, I'm not really going to talk about the laws. What I am going to try to talk about is to suggest some of the ideas and attitudes that have prevailed in the past, attitudes toward women and work, and a little bit about how those ideas were reflected in the kinds of policies that were adopted toward women in the labor force. And the basic change, of course, as is suggested in your program, is the change from, in terms of the laws that I'm not really going to talk about, is the change from a concern for humanizing industrial processes, and insofar as that was true for women, humanizing them by passing legislation that would protect women, that is, that would limit the number of hours that they could work, the number of pounds that they could lift, the amount of night work that they could undertake, and so on. And of course, as you know, today, what women are most concerned about is not with protective legislation, but with equality. That is, with the kind of legislation that will enable women in the workforce to be judged by the same standards and qualifications that men are. If there are limitations as far as how many pounds you can lift, if a woman is not allowed to lift more than 90 pounds, then a man should not be allowed to lift more than 90 pounds, and so on. But what I'd really like to do is to talk chiefly about the attitudes and ideas that prevailed in this state particularly toward women and the workforce, suggest a little bit about why those ideas prevailed, and suggest some of the consequences of those ideas. Now, I think probably all of us know that during World War II, women in large numbers entered the workforce in the United States because of the needs of the Second World War, because many of the able-bodied workers in all areas of industry were away at war, and therefore women were welcomed into positions that had previously been closed to them. But it's a mistake to think that that was the first time, that is, that the period of World War II was the first time that women were welcomed into the workforce. Because from the very earliest days of settlement in America, this country sought a cheap, durable, and docile workforce. A massive population that could be depended upon to turn an empty continent into a thriving civilization with a high standard of living. The founding fathers first tried making slaves of the Indians. Then they began importing vast numbers of black Africans. In rural America, large families seemed a good solution to the labor problem. Children could perform various tedious tasks from a very early age. Now, this was not an idea or a solution invented in America. For example, in England, children of families receiving poor relief were expected to begin doing some useful work at age 3. Now, I don't know how many 3-year-olds you know, but I think that boggles the mind. Now, women, of course, bore those children, they reared them, and they helped carry out the work of the family as well. Nevertheless, a labor shortage was a uniquely American problem, and the labor of women and children was always seen as an important solution. It's an interesting historical curiosity, maybe not so curious, that when laws were drafted regulating the lives and work of slaves, those laws were patterned after the common law regarding married women. And the great Alexander Hamilton, our first Secretary of the Treasury, when he wrote about how important it was to establish new industries in America, he found that one of the great things guaranteeing success would be that an appropriate labor supply was at hand, women and children, who would thereby be kept out of trouble and their nimble fingers busy. Now, according to the law of supply and demand, when there is a shortage of something, like labor, it is more highly valued. But this was never true of women working for a wage outside the home. Women were regarded as inferior in one way or another, in mind and body or both, and therefore less valuable than men. There was only one role that they were truly fitted for, that of being wife and mother. If they did anything else, or tried to, it was a little like, as Samuel Johnson said, like a dog walking on its hind legs, not done well, but surprising to think that it could be done at all. By the middle of the 19th century, this idea was elaborated into a veritable ideology, the cult of true womanhood. Women were designed by nature, it was said, to be pious, pure, and obedient. Like birds, they had a nesting instinct and were never so happy as when they were in the nest chirping to a clutch of fledglings. Unlike birds, however, they did not want to go on any migrations or look for a few worms for themselves. The true woman, it was said, was a spiritual being whose nature would be corrupted by the cold, cruel, money-grubbing world. The true woman was happy being submissive, first to her father and then to her husband. Now, this was a very handy set of attributes for potential employers. No good woman, according to the cult of true womanhood, wanted a career or a profession outside the home. She would, however, have a few good years, before she got married, during which she could be a wage earner. Ideally, she should work at something for which she was instinctively suited, like teaching, for example, which would appeal to her nurturing instincts. Better yet, she should go into domestic service, become a hired girl on the farm, or a servant in some city home. And this is really the way in which the law of supply and demand did work for women. That is, whenever you have an occupational structure which admits women only into certain areas, then obviously those areas are going to be more glutted than others. And that's what happened as far as women were concerned. Wages could be kept low. To pay a woman for a decent wage for doing what came naturally, for example, the nurturing or domestic service, to pay a woman a decent wage for doing these kinds of things would have been a little like paying men merely for having broad shoulders and beards. High wages, it was thought, might be corrupting of women's spiritual nature. Now, this happy set of attributes of employer ideas was first used extensively in the field of education, which we talked about last week and the week before. Almost everybody agreed that a democracy required a literate electorate. But almost nobody wanted to pay high taxes for a public school system. Therefore, young women were specifically sought to teach in the public schools because they'd do it for much less money than men would. Taxes could be kept down. This argument won over many a set of old fogies who opposed education at public expense. In the 19th century, therefore, as we've commented before in this series, women teachers customarily received only about two-thirds the pay men got for the same job. And of course, women did not rise into such positions as principal or superintendent because those were jobs that required the habit of command, not the nurturing instinct. Society was less successful in persuading young women that they ought to go into domestic service, that they ought to spend their premarital years in domestic service. In Minnesota, beginning in the 1880s, and I think we sometimes forget this because we tend to think of Minnesota as a rural agrarian state, but beginning in the 1880s, in Minnesota, when factories and mills were established in the Twin Cities, young girls from rural areas flocked to them. By 1907, greater proportion of young women lived away from their families in Minnesota than in any other state. Now, this was a constant puzzle to such groups as such official organs as the State Bureau of Labor Statistics, which couldn't understand why women would so ardently wish to leave their instinctive sphere to work in unhealthy factories. Women were not supposed to wish to live independent lives. Sometimes wealthy married ladies, struggling with the servant problem, urged the establishment of training schools for domestics. These schools, one such woman observed, these schools would elevate housekeeping in the common thought, would place it in the list of professions. These schools never quite materialized, although some of the Indian mission schools worked very hard to prepare Indian girls for laundry work, maid service, and so on. Some thought that that would be the nice natural pool of domestic labor. Factory and mill owners, however, were not at all unhappy to see young women come to work. These employers were able to draw a different set of corollaries from the Victorian ideology of true womanhood. Factory work was not a nurturing nesting activity. Therefore, women couldn't possibly do it well. Therefore, they shouldn't be paid as much as men. Or, to be fair, they assumed that women would at least not do it for as long. That is, that they could be hired for a few years, and then they would disappear and would do those things for which they were instinctively suited. To give you some idea of how this worked out in practice, that is, the low wages, the assumptions about women workers, in 1888, the minimum living wage for a single person in Minnesota was estimated to be between $7 and $8 a week, the minimum living wage. Most working women earned between $3 and $4, and they paid between $2 and $3 weekly for room and board. It doesn't leave a whole lot of pin money. To give you some idea of the amount of work that they performed for these wages, for example, sewing 2,200 burlap flour sacks in a day would earn the woman worker $1. Now, another rather ugly corollary of this is that working women were likely to be bad women with loose morals. This theme recurs throughout the history of women in the workforce. Debauchery is regarded as just around the corner. In at least one Minnesota mattress factory in the 1880s, a very hot, dusty place, the windows were nailed shut and painted over so that the women workers couldn't see men walking by and vice versa and all go berserk, especially in the mattress factory. Puritanism, in the popular sense, lived on well into the 20th century. For example, One Minnesota law of 1919 provided that separate toilet facilities for men and women must be, quote, constructed of such materials as are not transparent or translucent, and they shall be soundproof. Concern for morality and respectability vanished from employers' minds when the talk turned to better wages and working conditions. Morality and respectability, they then said, were inherent qualities of character. They had nothing to do with wages or working conditions. They had nothing to do with one's working environment. Death before dishonor was the only choice a true woman ought to make. By the late 19th century, as business became more complex and record keeping of all kinds increased, a new area of work opened for women, the clerical occupations, office work. There was a surplus of educated young women. Remember, women had, this is true in Minnesota, and it's true for the United States as a whole, women had a higher literacy rate than men until the 1940s. More women had been educated than could be absorbed in the teaching profession. Therefore, office work was seen as a reasonable answer. In 1913, University of Minnesota published a little booklet entitled Vocations for College Women. And in that little booklet, it suggested that graduates should aspire to become secretaries. One could become secretary to rich, intelligent, and powerful men. The booklet mentioned that some women might be interested in newspaper work, but advised them against pursuing a career in journalism. I quote from this 1913 booklet on vocations for college women. Most of the news of the day is gathered from men, and women are unable to handle men as successfully as men can. Employers of women clerical workers weren't looking for help that was too well educated. One of these employers wrote, for example, in 1925, "College graduates are not better than high school graduates. They are apt to have too many ideas of their own and buck the existing methods of doing things." Clerical and secretarial work was respectable. It became transformed into another patriarchal arrangement like the family. The secretary wasn't supposed to be any more assertive than the wife or daughter in the home. The boss could say of his secretary, as he did of his wife in the home, "I couldn't manage without her." But neither was supposed to have any ideas of her own. The secretary, like the wife, was supposed to make possible the man's grand designs. Now, this analogy between home and office, between wife and secretary, had, I think, ugly implications, especially for minority women who sought office work. Non-white secretaries for white businessmen were just as unacceptable as mixed marriages. A survey that was made in 1919 of employment opportunities for black women in Minneapolis got such responses as the following. "We are not employing any colored girls in this department, and for the time being, there are no openings for this class of help." Or this. "We had thought that we might use one of these girls," meaning a black woman, "at our telephone switchboard, but found that certain prejudices on the part of the white girl whose duty it was to relieve the operator made this impossible." The mixed office, like the mixed marriage, was seen as a threat to civilization as we know it. When the Depression of the 1930s came, women were urged not to compete for jobs with men, even when these women were the sole support of their families. And one of the aims that was pursued by various government relief and employment agencies was to lower women's aspirations. Copywriters were taught to be grateful for clerical work. Factory workers were supposed to be happy with housework and with domestic service. An interesting contrast, I think, to at least what we hear a lot about today, that we are concerned with raising women's aspirations, their professional and occupational aspirations. For example, a newsletter of the WPA in Minnesota in 1936 described the way they thought they could get women workers into housekeeping jobs. This WPA newsletter reads, "When they arrive," that is the women workers, "they are rather shy and discouraged, but when we put them into attractive uniforms and instruct them to take as much pride in those uniforms as a nurse does in hers, the transformation is complete. They become enthusiastic and energetic." Again, I don't know too many people whose attitude toward housework is transformed by being put into a special uniform. But hope springs eternal in the WPA and other official agencies. A survey that was done 2 years later showed that the wages domestic servants received were often no higher than the money they got when they were on relief. So whatever enthusiasm the uniforms imparted couldn't have lasted very long. This brings us back to the era of the Second World War, with which I began. There were, even though there had been many, many women in the workforce before the Second World War, there were really two things that were new about women and work during the 1940s. First of all, women were welcomed into skilled industrial jobs. They had been in factories doing factory and mill work before, but they were held in the lowest paid, unskilled possible jobs. So what begins to happen in the 1940s is that you get women welcome now in those skilled industrial jobs and given the kind of training they needed to hold them. That was another favorite excuse in decades gone by. Well, women would take too long to train them for these skilled jobs. Okay, in the 1940s, they needed that labor, and they provided the training. In earlier decades, it had been almost impossible for women to get apprenticeships or other kinds of training to upgrade their skills. And secondly, the second thing that's really new about the entry of women into the workforce in the 1940s is that married women and middle-aged women were encouraged to go to work. And such helping institutions as daycare centers were set up to make it possible for them more easily to do so. And despite avalanches of urgings after 1945, and despite the whole feminine mystique thing that we've all heard about, things were really never quite the same again after 1945. Married women and older women, like their younger sisters, single sisters, remained in the labor force in far greater numbers and percentages than they had in any previous years. More women in Minnesota entered the workforce between 1950 and 1960 than had entered between 1940 and 1950. And most of them did so because of economic need. That's another common myth about women in the workforce, that women who work don't really need to work, therefore nobody need feel bad when they get laid off or paid low wages, and so on. But that has historically not been the case. Most women work because they need to work. They need the money. In 1970, let me give you just a few figures here. In 1970, 40% of all Minnesota females above the age of 14 were employed. But if we look at, let's look at the city of Minneapolis, we find, again in 1970, that 42, now this is as of 1974, that 42% of working women were in the clerical field. Now that's 5% more than the national average, 5% more working women in the clerical field in Minneapolis than is the national average. On the other hand, 3% of working women in Minneapolis are in managerial positions. That's about 0.3% higher than the national average. But it's still true that, again, speaking only for Minneapolis, you see I've discreetly left out St. Paul here. Minneapolis men outnumber women 600-1 in executive positions. If we look at working women in comparison with men, we still find women clustered in the clerical and service occupations, earning salaries that are significantly lower than men's. That's one of the things that concerns people in higher education today. That is, a century of equal access to education has not changed those percentages very much. If we look at black women in Minnesota, we find that in our state, they are in higher paying occupational categories than black women nationally. They are, nevertheless, still disadvantaged with respect in comparison to other women in Minnesota. Now, these are, by and large, not particularly encouraging statistics. They're especially troubling, I think, when we, enter into a period of economic slump, but we are well into it. Because the old stereotypes about women workers are, I think, still waiting in the wings. They're ready for still a few more encores. And I would hope that we would not see a repeat of those commissions in the 1930s that attempted to lower women's employment aspirations. But I think already we can see some evidence of efforts to have women scale down their ambitions. College women interested in teaching are advised to become teacher's aides, paraprofessionals. Economists are trotting out the old shibboleths about women taking away jobs from deserving men. And almost everybody is talking about the decline of the American family and attributing it to you-know-who. Yeah. One of the interesting things, however, is that perhaps you saw 2 weeks ago, I believe, in Newsweek magazine, the cover story was called The Parenting Gap, in which it discussed problems currently within the American family. And for the first time in anything that I have seen, that article accepted the legitimacy and the reality of women working and did not in one line even suggest that everything would be all right again if women just all scurried back into the home. That is, for the first time at least that I've seen, there was in a publication of mass circulation, there was an awareness that the problems that beset the American family are much more complicated than can be solved merely by saying to all the women, drop your paychecks and hurry home again. And I think that's a step forward in sophistication. And also in the department of things to be concerned about, I think it's clear that the Equal Rights Amendment is in serious trouble. Now, I've talked about some of the stereotypes and inequalities, some of the stereotypes about women that have prevailed among employers, and not just among employers. But there have always been women in Minnesota, as elsewhere, who, especially in bad times, fought against the stereotypes that said it was all right for these inequalities and injustices to exist. For example, there were people like Eva Valish of the 1880s, who wrote a pioneering series of muckraking articles on women in factory work in Minnesota. And much later, in fact, still very much among us, people like Nellie Stone Johnson, who organized the Restaurant and Hotel Workers Union among blacks and Asian Americans in Minneapolis in the 1930s. And one of Nellie's techniques, Nellie was at that time an elevator operator. And what she did was, when she was recruiting for the union, was simply stop the elevator between floors and talk to all the folks. And people like Elizabeth Quinlan, businesswoman who served on the Industrial Advisory Board here in the 1930s of young Quinlan fame, the board that this Industrial Advisory Board that urged there must be scientific vocational guidance for women instead of massive business training. Again, touching upon the problem of channeling all women into a few occupations, thereby depressing wages. And I think these are some of the directions that we're moving in today, toward hopefully an acceptance of women as workers on the same basis as men as workers are accepted, judged by the same criteria. And I think that in this sense, we have come some distance, though not the whole distance, from those early days in Minnesota when the windows were painted over and the doors nailed shut. Thank you very much.
Dr. Berman is going to lecture now on the unions in Minnesota, United States, and how the change came about. Women originally were, it was very open for women to belong to labor unions. Now it's a little close.
Something like that. I'm glad that Gretchen went into the attitudes of employers, which essentially is the attitudes of society, really, to women workers in the 19th and 20th century in the United States and in Minnesota. I think that helps really put into context some of the things that I'm going to talk about in relationship to the efforts at attempting to humanize work for women as well as for men in the industrial environment. But before I do that, I think it's essential to point out that women have always been an integral and necessary part of the industrial labor force as long as there has been an industrial capitalist society in Western Europe. That industrialization of the 17th century in England, of the late 18th and early 19th century in the United States, was based upon the exploitation of women and children as an integral and necessary part of the capital accumulation, or as Karl Marx put it, primitive capital accumulation. And I think in these hallowed walls we can use Karl Marx's name. In this mansion on Summit Avenue, that this primitive capital accumulation, which was absolutely essential in order to create the wherewithal to develop an industrial capitalism in the Western world. Of course, if we read the writings of the labor historians of England, among whom, of course, would be people like the Webbs or Engels, The Conditions of the Working Class in England, for instance, a classic work describing the development of English industrialization in the 17th and 18th, rather in the 18th and 19th century. It's full of detailed discussions of the manner by which women workers and children were absolutely essential to the process of industrial development. Now, this was replicated in the United States. When Samuel Slater and his companions in the New England Company established the textile mills in Massachusetts, Rhode Island, the labor force for these mills came from the source that was recommended by Alexander Hamilton, that Gretchen spoke about. The Waltham experiment was commented upon widely in Europe by humanitarians like Harriet Martineau and Charles Dickens. They commented upon it because in the Waltham experiment, the girls, and they were all girls, were brought to work in the textile mills and were set up in sororities, kind of quasi or pseudo sororities, where every moment of their life was regimented. And of course, Harriet Martineau saw the spick and span living quarters, the fact that that sure, they worked 12 and 14 hours a day, but the rest of the time was spent in a kind of fellowship of feminine warmth. They put out a newspaper and a magazine of, well, I guess you call it middle low or middle high literature, if you want to, however you want to put it. And Charles Dickens was impressed with this, and of course he contrasted that with the experience of the British textile mills, the English textile mills, where children primarily and not young women were rigorously exploited. But what Harriet Martineau and Charles Dickens and Samuel Slater and of course Daniel Webster, if we'll bring in some of the politicians of the time that were defending this, what they didn't mention was the fact that this regimentation, this exploitation, led in eventually to an explosion of the women themselves. A young woman in the Waltham factory by the name of Sarah Bagley organized the women not to turn out kind of pseudo-romantic poetry for their journal, but organized the women to turn out a series of protest literature against the exploitation and regimentation of their lives. Sarah Bagley didn't last long in that kind of setting. She formed the New England Labor Reform Association and cooperated and worked closely with the labor reformers of the time. Well, what happened in New England, of course, was that the Waltham system was discarded, and in its place, other women and children were brought into the workforce. And this, of course, was the new system, the Fall River system, which was not so rigorously regimented, but in a different way was exploitative, in the sense that immigrant workers, and that meant immigrant women and children, and in fact whole families, were recruited to work in the factories, and these Anglo-Saxon native women, the daughters of independent American farmers, would not turn out a Sarah Bagley anymore. It was more obviously profitable to work out a family system of exploitation than to bring in these independent Sarah Bagley types into the factory system. Nonetheless, the system of exploitation as a means of capital, primitive capital accumulation, in the early years of industrialization depended heavily on the labor of women and children. And Minnesota was no different. To be sure, our dark and satanic mills were perhaps cold and damp rather than dark and satanic, but they were exploitative nonetheless. In the 1870s, the wage-earning women were to be found in almost every type of factory employment in Minnesota. Cigar making, garment manufacturing, in flour milling, to be sure, they weren't doing the heavy work, but as Gretchen pointed out, they were sewing the sacks. I guess it's hard to say whether this is garment manufacturing or flour milling, but nonetheless, they were employed by the Washburns and the Pillsburys. In fact, the first report issued by the Minnesota Bureau of Labor after it was established, in 1887, the first report that it issued, the first of its biennial reports, was devoted to women workers, a survey of attitudes. To be sure, most of it dealt with domestic service. And I guess that was because the overwhelming majority of the women employed at that time, or at least the most visible of the women employed at that time, were in domestic service. But this report did not deal with other types of employment that women were engaged in the early years of industrialization in Minnesota. They were typographers, cigar makers, box makers, artificial flower makers, among the occupations you find women wage earners occupying at that time. Now, the normal attribute of workers feeling themselves after a period of time being put upon, exploited, or having grievances, the normal response of workers in that kind of situation is to band together to try to resolve their difficulties collectively. This, of course, is called organization. To some of the employers and to society at large, this could be, and in fact, up until recent years, has been thought to be un-American and subversive. It goes contrary to the basic assumptions of the work ethic, of the hierarchical organization of society, of entrepreneurial liberty, of all of the principles of Americanism that were preached by the politicians, from the pulpits, and from the press. In developing this concept of collective action, or unions, if you want to call them that, economic organizations to redress grievances through collective action. In doing this, of course, the workers in the United States and in Minnesota turned to past experiences. Trade unionism developed out of the experiences of workers in similar circumstances. And it was basically, as I suggested, a response to exploitation. Now, there are two forms of organizations that were developed because there were two forms of experiences that seemed to fit the needs of workers in Minnesota and the nation. One is an organization of people with similar skills, crafts, or callings, since they had much in common in this regard. And the second was an organization of all workers in a particular wage setting, in a particular industrial setting, or a particular factory, regardless of skills. The first form led directly to craft unionism, and the second to, eventually to industrial unionism. But in the 19th century experience, it led to the formation of some kind of ephemeral reform movement that looked like a labor movement but really wasn't, called the Knights of Labor. Now, I go into all this because there is a kind of indigenous reaction of each of these two types of organizations to the fact that a substantial proportion of the labor force, of their co-workers, were women, and the reaction thereto. Among the craft organizations, the desire, and one of the major desires of organizing in craft lines, among the craft organizations, the basic desire was to maintain a degree of monopoly control over the job market, to prevent unskilled or, if not unskilled, then at least unprepared or poorly prepared, or as they defined it, unfairly competitive workers from entering into their craft lines. This then led to the inevitable development of collective agreements which sought to exclude others. That is to say, the closed shop. Of course, it wasn't easy to come by, not given the reaction on the attitude of the society at large and of employers to the fact that workers should be seen and not heard. But nonetheless, as far as women was concerned, in the most exclusive of the craft organizations, there was the attitude that women constituted an economic, unfair, competitive group that should be excluded from the ranks. Or at best, they should be held to the same levels of craft achievement as the members of the craft union. And then, if they are able to perform at the same level, should be allowed to organize into separate women's unions of the same craft. This latter kind of attitude was held by the more socially advanced members of craft union organizations. It was the former attitude that was more prevalent. As far as the Knights of Labor or the industrial union form of organization is concerned, there they took a different stance. There, the purview, the kind of setting that they envisioned was a setting of all workers. They saw the competitive nature of the labor market not being divided up into small craft lines, but they saw the competitive nature of the labor market as not being worker against worker, but worker against employer. Therefore, they viewed the necessity to organize all workers in a particular setting, regardless of skill, regardless of craft, regardless of occupation, regardless of race, and regardless of sex. The Knights of Labor, from the very moment that it ceased being a secret organization in 1878, immediately went out positively to recruit women workers into the Knights of Labor. Through the efforts of people like Leonora O'Reilly, who headed the women's division of the Knights of Labor, which was started, as far as I know, even earlier than 1878, but before 1878, the Knights of Labor was a secret organization, and as a consequence, historians have to depend upon the documentary record, and we don't have any documentary record before 1878 on it, except hearsay. But the women's division was headed by Leonora O'Reilly in 1878, and perhaps even earlier. Mrs. Barry in the 1880s went around throughout the United States talking about cooperation, equality, recruitment of women, blacks. In fact, there was two very interesting conventions of the Knights of Labor, which I will just very quickly mention, which will perhaps suggest the kind of organization it was. Of course, it was a bit fuzzy-minded in many ways, but the major thrust of the Knights of Labor was cooperation and collective bargaining in a rough kind of way. In Minneapolis, the Knights were very, very successful in being able to organize Cooper cooperatives. And because one of the elder Pillsbury's was some kind of radical, what form I don't know, one of the elder Pillsbury's was some kind of radical, and he turned over to the Minneapolis Cooper cooperatives, the Knights of Labor, the complete contract to turn out all of the barrels that the Pillsbury's needed in the 1884 to about 1887. That the Cooper Cooperative in Minneapolis, or Cooper Cooperatives in Minneapolis, were very, very successful, so successful that they had to recruit labor to work for them. The workers who were recruited, men and women both, were not willing, those that they recruited, to become part of the cooperative and therefore to defer their gains to the end of the year profit sharing kind of system, but wanted higher wages. But this went contrary to the will of the cooperators. Consequently, when the Knights of Labor held their convention, or their General Assembly as they called it, here, not here, but across the river in Minneapolis, in 1887, when Terence Powderly and the Knights leaders came off the train, they were greeted by pickets holding signs, "The Knights of Labor unfair to labor." And among the women, among the rather pickets holding these signs were women. Another example of the kind of organization the Knights was, a year later in 1888, the Knights Convention was held in Richmond, Virginia. Now Richmond, Virginia, we all know, is in the South in 1888, only a little less than 25 years after the Civil War. To be sure, the racial attitudes had not yet been fully hardened into what became, of course, the segregated racist attitudes of later, but it was pretty rough in Richmond. The Knights of Labor chose to have the convention opened by Frank Farrell, a black knight, introducing the governor of Virginia. And they chose to have Mrs. Barry thank the governor after his speech. This was done deliberately to show that the Knights were open to blacks and to women. Now, to come back to Minnesota, the Knights, through District Assembly 79, the efforts of Jack McGoy, Brosnan, and others, was the instrument through which Eva McDonald Valish was introduced into the labor movement. And I won't say any more than that. But even the craft organizations, even the organizations that formed into craft unions, which later became the foundation for the American Federation of Labor, were organizing themselves into city organizations, city centrals, the trades and labor assemblies, the central labor unions. In 1882, the St. Paul Trades and Labor Assembly was formed, and in November of that year, it met to ratify its constitution. In its constitution, it had, of course, a preamble, as most constitutions do, which stated its purpose and its objectives. Objective number 6 listed by the Trades and Labor Assembly of St. Paul was equal pay for equal work, regardless of race or sex. A radical thought for those days, perhaps even a radical thought for these days. But the 1882 Statement of Objectives of the Trades and Labor Assembly of St. Paul was replicated and repeated by the Central Labor Body of Minneapolis, Duluth, Mankato. And in 1890, when all of these labor bodies came together to form the State Labor Federation, the objective listed, again, by the Federation, among the objectives, was equal pay for equal work. Now, how does one reconcile, if one can, the contrary, seemingly contrary, objectives of the craft unions? On the one hand, exclusion. On the other, equal pay for equal work. They're the same bodies, really. It's the same group of people. Well, I guess one reconciles it by looking at self-interest. Since the attitude of employers and society was to use women and minorities as an instrument to keep wage levels down, then obviously it's to the advantage of those who combine together for defensive purposes to either keep the minorities and women out, and if they can't be kept out, then to have them get the same pay, period. So it's not a question of contradiction here. It's using different tactics to get the same end result. Now, women were difficult to organize. At least that's what my informants tell me. My informants are long dead, but that's what their papers tell me. That women were very difficult to organize. They were not stable, steady. They were not readily available. They were always moving around. They were. In fact, the ideology or the thought that they were temporary sojourners in the labor force, this even permeated the minds of the labor reformers and the labor organizers. But the efforts were made, and results were apparent, even in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. In St. Paul, to give an example among many, the United Garment Workers were successful in getting the women garment workers working in St. Paul factories organized into locals of the United Garment Workers. To be sure, these locals were all women. It was not a mixed local, because the men were either cutters, which was a higher skill level and a higher wage level, or pressers, which required more physical dexterity and therefore more highly paid. But nonetheless, they were successful. The early successes, and of course I shouldn't over-exaggerate here, because there were women that were brought into the normal unions themselves. The typographical workers had women members as early as the 1870s and 80s. The cigar makers had women members as early as the 1880s. So that this exclusionary side has, of course, its limitations. But whatever successes did exist came to a screeching halt in Minnesota, at least, in 1903. And I can, date it, 1903. Why? What happened in 1903? Well, nothing that I could see happened in 1903 that's really exciting. It isn't 1893, a Great Depression. It isn't the Great War. I don't know what happened in 1903 except one little item. An organization of traditional employers, elitist employers, did organize themselves in 1903 called the Citizens Alliance with the objective of preventing any organization whatsoever. Maybe that's what happened in 1903. And from 1903 on, there was a kind of hiatus in the organizing activities in Minnesota. That isn't to say that there was, or organizing success, that isn't to say that there weren't efforts made. As a matter of fact, in 1905, in Chicago, the Women's Trade Union League was organized. And although its major dramatic successes occurred in New York, the Women's Trade Union League had certain minimal, modest achievements even in Minnesota. To be sure, most of the members of the Women's Trade Union League in Minnesota were residents of Lowry Hill or Summit Avenue. The reason for that being that the Women's Trade Union League was an instrument by which the society women, the more advanced society women, socially advanced, politically advanced society women, felt that they could utilize this vast, untapped resource of working women to achieve both social justice and eventually the vote for women. It's not surprising that the leading suffragettes were the major force behind the Women's Trade Union League. And it's not surprising that one of the earliest recruits to women's suffrage was Samuel Gompers, as a result of the activities of the Women's Trade Union League. The Women's Trade Union League, the Women's Union Label League, the women's auxiliaries of the various unions, all of these did work within the progressive era in order as a means of raising consciousness not only of women workers, but of the society at large, of the exploitative nature of the industrial system upon women and children. Yes, their emphasis was on protective legislation, and they were they did cooperate very strongly with people like John R. Commons and the American Society for Labor Legislation, which was instrumental in getting most of the protective legislation that were passed in the states in the early part of the 20th century through. But they were also convinced that the only way that improvements can be made in the lot of the working women was through self-organization. And the Women's Trade Union League did in fact sponsor organizing activities that eventually led to strikes, showdowns, and some minimal degree of organization. The attempts to organize women, to integrate them into the labor movement, is a story in and of itself. As far as Minnesota is concerned, the craft unions in Minnesota, which were dominant in the labor movement up until the 1930s, were a little bit more advanced than were the craft unions in the rest of the country. Perhaps the reason for this was that the union leadership in Minnesota was looked upon as a consequence of Citizens Alliance activities, perhaps, was looked upon as subversive. And this was true even if the union leadership was of the most conservative variety. George Lawson, McEwen, these people who were the heads of the Federation of Labor in the period of the First World War, right after the First World War, were really more conservative than Samuel Gompers. They were to the right, I mean, if we were to compare them today, they would be to the right of Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan would be a flaming liberal in comparison. But what pushed them into a more advanced position? It was the fact that the minimal advances made in the period from 1880 to 1919 were physically destroyed and brutally destroyed during World War I, pushing them into a position of going into what we would call radical politics, third-party politics. And it was through the farmer labor movement of the 1920s and the influence of the farmer labor movement on the traditional labor movement, on the State Federation of Labor, on the Trades and Labor Assembly, on the Central Labor Union, and through the activities of even more radical labor groups like the communists and the socialists, that the labor movement in Minnesota was much more responsive to the needs and wishes and the aspirations of the women workers in this state. As we go into the 1930s, of course, the fruition of this movement comes about in the organizing activities of the CIO and the stimulus that the CIO gave to organizing activities of the old craft unions, leading directly to the formation of a union which was mentioned by Gretchen, Local 665 of the Hotel and Restaurant Workers in Minneapolis, to the United Office and Professional Workers Union, to the Retail Clerks Union, and more importantly, to the coming to positions of leadership in the labor movement of key women workers. Now, to be sure, World War II saw an influx of women into the labor force, but World War II, or after World War II, saw a diminution of women taking leading positions in the labor movement. And it's kind of almost an inverse ratio. The more women were coming into the labor force, the less leadership positions they held in the labor movement. And women in the labor movement recognized this, and 2 years ago in Chicago, they formed an association of women unionists to use their strength and effort at bringing in equal opportunity in the labor movement as well. Well, this is a rough kind of outline and a tentative kind of outline of the women in the Minnesota labor movement. And it's really, I was just thinking out loud with you, because most of the material that I've put together for this has just come out of the reading of the documents and things like that. It just doesn't appear in a single kind of an article that you can just quickly read, or a book that you can quickly read. Now, these are just some tentative thoughts of my own based on the reading of the manuscripts and documentary materials, and, as I say, tentative conclusions, subject to change when I get more material. Thank you.
We'll have a 5-minute stretch, and we'll come back and ask some questions.